Look, I'm going to level with you. I have my own things to deal with. After all, we are about to have a lovely landing.
The Orphans, an original cinematic audio drama, is now available.
And now, The Orphans Facility, an exciting new prequel series. Catch up with Season 1 with new episodes of Facility coming bi-weekly.
State of the Empire is presented by the Nerdy Show Podcast Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse, and is brought to you in part by Consequence of Sound, the web's foremost source for music and film news, reviews, and insights. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, and with the generous support of listeners like you. To learn how you can support this and other fine geek programming, visit nerdyshow.com. Welcome to State of the Empire, Nerdy Show's Star Wars speculation podcast, where we look for news in Alderaan places. Hi, I'm Cap.
Hey, I'm Doug.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And this is our long-awaited Rogue One postmortem episode. Because in the weeks and months following the release of Rogue One, when we weren't releasing State of the Empire episodes during a very busy early year, a lot of new news came out. A lot of interviews and random pieces of information revealing just how strange this film production truly was. The end result was a film that we liked a lot. Go back and listen to our review immediately after we saw the film for the first time, and since then we've seen it many more times. But what's important about analyzing Rogue One over 6 months later is that it's a very significant stepping stone in the process of Star Wars evolving into this new era of what the franchise has become, the Disney era. The anthology films, the Star Wars story films, finding out if this experiment actually works. And it was something that Kathleen Kennedy of Lucasfilm many times over mentioned that it was, you know, of great concern. So learning how much shifted and how much is different and how much the much publicized and scandalized reshoots affected the film paints an interesting narrative, and it is in many ways one of the greatest stories of this new era of Star Wars not being told. Whether or not this final product was stronger, this fixed film, the film we saw in theaters, was stronger than what it could have been, or maybe it was watered down and made more safe, the development cycle of this film is fascinating, and no one's really talking about it, for obvious reasons. But that's counterintuitive in many regards to Star Wars, because Star Wars has always been about the story of making crazy films.
I think they're the most well-documented productions ever. I mean, I think we know, fans know, every little detail about how these films were made, at least the originals, and certainly a significant chunk of the prequels.
And because they were intentionally canonized and made legendary, not just because they were huge films, but because George Lucas, as a filmmaker who loves films, put money and effort and time into making things like the VHS from Star Wars to Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And having an entire fan club dedicated to sharing, behind-the-scenes information and so on.
Well, it naturally got people curious because they were seeing things that they couldn't explain how they were done. How did they do that? We've never seen anything like this before. Tell us the secrets.
I mean, it really popularized the idea of what filmmaking was. I think it brought that aspect of film into a very significant pop culture zeitgeist.
So we planned for this episode to get made, a ways back, right after Star Wars Celebration. But it's been a bit of a hassle to schedule this show. And, now that Han Solo thing has happened, we've just spent the past two episodes of State of the Empire talking about what we do and don't know about directors Lord Miller being fired and replaced by Ron Howard. This being the Han Solo film being only the second Star Wars anthology film, and already there's a scandal, much like there was a scandal regarding the reshoots for Rogue One. This is fascinating and also, worrisome, obviously, because we don't really know what it means, and there's so much we don't know about who's really steering this ship. And, we're analyzing it not just as fans who want a good movie, but also as people who grew up on Star Wars, who've made something of a career out of analyzing the filmmaking process, and being just fascinated by this train wreck that's also a mystery. Because we, as the general populace, are not privy to this information because it's sensitive. Depending on whose fingers get pointed at whom, it could, you know, damn careers.
Not to mention, there's a lot of strange things happening. Like, for everything that happened on Rogue One, and especially everything that's happening on the Han Solo film, those are rarities for non-mainstream, non-franchise films. But the fact that it's happening on, like, a film that's part of the largest franchise in, well, like, Earth history, you know? It just makes it even more fascinating.
So this is going to be kind of an odd episode because it's a recap of a movie that came out over 6 months ago based on a ton of information that we haven't necessarily had a chance to discuss on the show yet, and us sort of trying to figure out what it all means. And this seems like an interesting place to bring up an iTunes review that we just got. This is from Bew Franklin, and it's a 2-star review, I'm sad to say. The title is Bummer. They say, "I genuinely used to love this podcast. It was my favorite Star Wars podcast. I'm now finding it a grind to listen to because it's negative beginning to end. I'm no rose-tinted glasses Star Wars fan, detest the prequels, but everything Disney does with it is now nitpicked within an inch of its life by this crew. There's telling it like it is, and then there's being so pretentious about something you become a snob. Hate to say it, but that's where this is now. Shame." And that's too bad. Brace yourself, Bew, because, oh boy, we're about to nitpick, but this is all out of love, and the nitpicking is only a byproduct of us trying to explore these films.
The deeper mysteries, as Palpatine would say. The side of the story that the Jedi wouldn't tell you.
And we felt the need to bring this up because it has been a dark couple of shows solely because of this Han Solo news and how fucked up it is, really. What you're listening to, what you're hearing, is us just reeling in confusion over what it all means.
And I think there's a difference between being confused and passionate than being entitled. I don't think Star Wars owes me anything. Some would be like, well, it owes us a good movie and a good time. I'm like, well, not even that. Like, Star Wars is always the weird experimental, you know, sci-fi movie. And the potential, now that Disney has it, to do so many new and so many cool things, it just, I mean, for me personally, it's like, the idea is actually kind of exciting on all the different places it can go and all the different mediums it can explore and tell awesome stories in this universe. But I don't feel like I'm owed anything. There's a transaction. I give you money, you give me the thing. You know, you give me the movie or you give me the comic book or whatever. But since we're about to talk about Rogue One, I don't feel betrayed or like let down. It's more of let's explore what this is and where does it fit in the grand scheme of things. And it's hard for me to like fully explain why I don't. None of it bums me out. Even if I complain about it, I don't feel bad. I don't feel like betrayed. I'm just want to see more, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that bugs me the most about modern filmmaking is, particularly in blockbusters, there's so many missed opportunities and you can watch them whizzing by. Because the landscape of film is ever changing, and we're in a cycle now where there's, you know, an abundance of films created by committee and the results are not great. And the weird thing about Disney's work is that the results generally are pretty good. I like Rogue One, you know? Like, there's some things about it where I cock my eyebrow at it and be like, really now? Why did you do that? Or what the hell does that mean? But, you know, in general, I remember the buzz I had when I first came out of the theater of, like, I just saw a Star Wars. Like, that was a real Star Wars, and it was crazy. But I feel like being a news and rumors podcast where we look for news in Alderaan places, we're going to get our hands dirty. You know, that's just like, that's the business.
Yeah, we'll be excited when we're excited about things and we'll be upset when there's things that may rub us the wrong way. But it doesn't mean our love is diminished for the franchise.
We've got to be cautious. We remain extremely cautious, cautiously yes. Optimistic, perhaps.
I mean, Obi-Wan said it. Must be cautious. Like, you know, it wasn't just like, oh, we're going to go in and like embrace the Mos Eisley Cantina and hug every like alien we come across. You know, there's some scum and villainy, like any good Star Wars movie.
Yeah, there are mysterious dealings going on. We don't know what they mean. We can only guess. And that's part of the ride.
This is part of this phase. Like you said, Cap, like we're right now in the midst of a system that does these like not great films, typically. Like, I mean, some of them have been, you know, some films in the current Hollywood system have been great, but like mostly it's just they're okay with good because they're formulaic and they have a system now. And it won't always be like that. So we're looking at the movies that they're making now within this system.
And as they establish this experiment of what these Star Wars story films can be, it's going to be a long time, if ever, before they fess up what their thoughts actually, you know, were and what was a a hit and a miss and where the stress actually was. And we're just curious to know. We want to find out. So we thought it fitting to read that review because we are definitely going to be wading through some stuff right now. But the only reason we do this show, being one Star Wars podcast in a unending sea of Star Wars podcasts, we're doing it because we love it and we love getting together and talking about these movies. Hopefully whoever you are, will find it fun and insightful.
We talk about the film industry as a whole, but it's really a house that Star Wars built. It's like, you know what I'm saying? Like the modern film studio, it was so influenced by the success of the first Star Wars. I don't know how we can imagine how it would have gone if the first Star Wars never happened. Is it a victim of its own success?
Could be. Or maybe not. That's what we're here to kind of conjecture. Yeah.
Or will it continue to break the rules, continue to push film forward? That's the big question.
So, Rogue One, right? What I said earlier about these interviews have been key here. Post-film interviews. We've learned so many weird things. Statements that I do genuinely wonder if they're true or if they've been somewhat fabricated or altered solely to give a better impression of the film. Because, look, I mean, if a film needs reshoots to change directions entirely for the better, so be it. I mean, it doesn't matter that there were reshoots. It doesn't matter. Where the questions come in is that we have been told, as fans and consumers and so on and so forth, that the reshoots were no big deal. But we know, like, for a fact now, that they were a huge deal. And that there was reasons for why all the trailers featured a ton of shots that were not in the film at all. And it potentially indicated, one could assume, that it indicated whole sequences and plot threads that didn't make it in the final film. And now we've been told that, oh, we were just goofing around, basically. We're just filming random stuff. And I want to think that that wasn't a lie, but...
That's too expensive to just be messing around. Like, to just spend a couple hours each day keeping crews on to film things that, like, look pretty and might be in the movie, but, like, there's no use for. Like, on a blockbuster film like that, like...
Well, what they told you was true from a certain point of view. Because I think a lot... Well, what Gareth Edwards said was a lot of the... Some of the shots, like, especially the one of, like, Jin in that tunnel that's being all lit up, they had that set there, and he saw someone literally turn on the lights to that, like, that part of the set, and they just naturally turned on in that sequence, and it caught his eye, and he was like, oh damn, that would make a great shot, get Felicity Jones over there and, like, get her to stand in there and let's just do a cool pose for like 2 seconds, like, shoot it without sound, one setup, two takes, go.
I'd be okay with that if, like, not every single other shot from that particular trailer ended up not in the movie. Like, was the entire first trailer, like, Indie Hour, as he called it? Like, I'm just saying, I know people that have, when they read that article about Gareth Edwards' Indie Hour, people that work on active blockbuster film sets saying that that's a ridiculous notion. That's not going to happen.
Well, I mean, couldn't it just as easily be that since this is, like, a big risky thing, Disney's probably, I mean, I'm just going to play devil's advocate. What if they're, like, breathing down his neck and they're like, hey, man, show us some things. We gotta make a trailer out of this. We gotta get a teaser out here.
And just to be clear, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, and I will have many exact quotes later on, but for some reason I don't have this one. Gareth Edwards essentially said, so we had this thing every day that we just called Indie Hour, where we just did cool shots. We just did cool shots every day, and we were filming a bunch early on, and the department that made trailers saw them, liked them, and just spliced them all together. And boom, that's why there's so many weird shots. That's why there's stormtroopers walking through the surf. That's why Krennic is on the beach. No.
Well, I think Krennic was on the beach because, I mean, as we'll get into later, that sequence was chopped up. I mean, probably for the better, but that sequence was chopped up between two different towers, and also because, like, you know, the Tarkin aspect of the movie was a kind of a late addition. Like, I don't think that was supposed to be Krennic's end, so to speak.
So... essentially, the picture that we've been painted is of a film that was transmuted at least twice. There's a reason that on Force Friday, when the new Star Wars figures came out, you could buy a figure for Sergeant Jyn Erso, who was a member of the Rebel Alliance from the get-go. Because, I mean, if you look at the timeline, there's got to be no question that only happened because she was Sergeant Jyn Erso of the Rebel Alliance up until those reshoots happened in the late summer.
Yeah.
There's no other way. And that means that that entire character's arc, the central character for the film, faced unheard of revision.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's even quotes on that Jin, I mean, that was something that came out of Celebration, right? Where they admitted that Jin originally was just a member of the Alliance.
Yeah, no, they did, but what they haven't, I mean, they have flat out said that. Obviously, they can't deny it. We have the action figure, but the thing is that they haven't addressed when that was, and they've, in all the panels that we attended pertaining to Rogue One at Star Wars Celebration, they shared a lot of amazing and cool concepts that, you know, many films have amazing and cool concepts that don't make it in. What they never provided information on was when exactly the kibosh was put on those concepts and how far things got along, with them thinking they were going to go one direction with the film until they zigzagged sharply. Now, there's a whole list of cool stuff we're going to talk about that was probably extinguished before the actual original principal photography started. But then things like Jen's story arc, I'm pretty certain that was filmed and then discarded, and we're never going to see that. I mean, and maybe it's fine. Maybe that's for the better. Totally. It's possible. But it's odd. It's very odd. And, I mean, they wanted this film to be a success because it was a do-or-die thing. I think doing Star Wars anthology films is no-brainers. You've been making film-quality stories since 1977 in the Expanded Universe. Well, you know, not consistently, but
yeah,
throughout. And so this is no big deal to me. They were always going to succeed with this, as far as I'm concerned. But they, risking millions of dollars, were very concerned. So here's the changes that exposed the severity of the reshoots. There's the action figure, of course. They announced the existence of Rogue One prequel comics, and then were on the verge of announcing who was attached to write and draw these comics, and then canceled those comics very quietly.
Yeah, very quietly. The only notice I saw was Amazon letting people know that their pre-orders had been canceled.
That's shocking. That says story changes. That says massive story changes, so much so that Marvel didn't believe that they could offer the proper editorial focus without potentially screwing something up within, what, about 8 months of development. Now, there was no Rogue One time material until April 2017.
And a lot of that material, there's some interesting things in it, but I don't know if I'm looking into, like, I've been reading, Cap, you've been reading the Rogue One, not the comic.
Yes.
I don't know if you've been getting, like, you've been sending me some very interesting things, but I don't know your general, like, kind of overall opinion about it. But I will say the novels, the young adult novels that have been coming out, Guardian of the Wills and Rebel Rising, have feel rushed and neutered. I mean, there's some interesting things. Saw Gerrera becomes a very interesting character because they actually tie in his Clone Wars background a lot better. You know, he's severely affected by the death of his sister, Steela, from the Clone Wars. And also, having witnessed the conversion of his resistance on Onderon from the Clone Wars to the Empire, like, war never ended for him. So he becomes a much more dynamic character to me, just showing that his entire life has been war. He's never had a chance to, you know, like, he just turned and started fighting a new enemy. Essentially, he had started fighting a group that, like, had previously been helping him during the Clone Wars. So it's very, very interesting.
Well, and how about the Guardian of the Wills book is backstory for Basil and Cherries, a.k.a.
Yes.
Baze and Troot. Was there any real insight to that? Because, I mean, that's a great opportunity to learn more about the place of the Force in the universe.
Jedha is an interesting character, like the planet. Just the Holy City, really, because it's not just like the world's religions have come to Jedha, which is an important thing, too. It's not just like the Guardian of the Wills or the Temple of the Kyber. There are dozens and dozens of religions. But also, like, dozens, possibly hundreds of religions have come and, like, since, like, become insignificant while they're there. Like, abandoned temples to religions that haven't been, like, a factor in the universe for hundreds of years, which I think is really interesting. It's like a super Jerusalem, you know? Like, it's very interesting. Like, Greg Rucka does a good job with that. But, like, Troot and Baze, they have a good rapport, very similar to the movies. But what I actually think is very interesting is they are very aware of Saw Gerrera. They worked with his partisan group for a significant amount of time before, like, you know, obviously they start seeing some conflict of you know, what they're doing. Once again, giving a lot more, like, I mean, kind of the contrast of, like, Saw when he still has, like, he's kind of still with it during Rebel Rising when Jin is young. And then to get to, like, where he's at in Guardians of the Wills, which is much closer to the start of Rogue One. Like, it's, I honestly, Saw is the most interesting character, I think, like, on a, through, you know, over the entire canon. Saw is a very interesting character, but the novels themselves just, I feel like something, you know, they all probably had to be rewritten, or they were conceived of not until, you know, the reshoots were finished and they knew what the new backgrounds for these characters were.
And then written very quickly. Yes. So that's...
In April. It's pretty significant.
Yeah.
4 months.
Yeah. And what you're saying about Saw and how dynamic he is and how much, you know, you were able to learn about him, Kathleen Kennedy has said some relatively cryptic quotes about how they wanted to do much more with Saw initially, which, considering how much they changed Jen's path, I can only assume happened on screen. And, of course, there was a minor controversy when people saw, you know, Saw's hair change in the trailers, and they're like, what does it mean? And I think that I can't remember what we said exactly, but I assume we all thought, well, you know, it just means that time has passed. So it's just, you know, one the other. But the reality is that it actually did mean something, and that was that there was clearly more stuff filmed with short-haired Saw Gerrera.
I think this movie was originally conceived of to be a lot more about, like, the gray areas. I mean, I remember that during the marketing of the film when they first announced it. Like, you know, what, you know, that things aren't necessarily good and evil, that there's a middle ground, and you can kind of see that a lot still in Cassian's character with, like, the horrible things that he is capable of doing in the beginning of the movie. But Saw's interesting because that first trailer, he has that quote in his short hair days when he says, like, you know, when they come to find you, you know, like, what will you become? Like, there is a sinister, dark aspect to, like, what Jin is possibly capable of, at least conceived of in that initial trailer. So I think that's where a lot of Saw's, like, I don't even know if he was, like, it may have been the opposite. Jin may be the person who's done some dark things, and Saw was the one that was trying to keep her, you know, level. Or, you know, who knows? But I think Saw changed the most, probably. Which is why they scrapped everything without hair, except for an on-screen, like an on-vid monitor, you know, shot of him saying that he, you know, when, you know, Krennic showed up to the Orson homestead, and when he came to pick her up out of the hole.
Yeah, and as to your question about the Rogue One comic adaptation, like, I like it. You know, normally, when comic adaptations are very difficult, because they either are exactly the film, and you're like, why am I reading this? Why am I spending money on this? Or they can give something back. And in this case, the first issue opens with a letter from Gareth Edwards saying, hey, you know, there was so much we wanted to include in the story and so much we weren't able to. I was so glad to have the opportunity to, you know, go over with the Marvel team and include some extra material here that gives further development for characters. And yeah, it's great. There's some great added stuff. I mean, it's not as much as I would like. There's not as much added stuff as I feel like would really be truly worthwhile. Maybe if they released it as an original graphic novel instead of, you know, releasing it by issue and then collecting it, maybe there would have been room for the extra pages that they really needed to add more. But it does offer, I think, throughout, greater emotional clarity and character development. That was, like, character development was one of the big criticisms of the film from just about everybody, is that they seem like they're great characters, but we didn't get enough of them to really connect.
I think that might be one of my most resounding impressions in the movie 6 months later, is with a lot of the other Star Wars films, I wasn't clamoring, like, of course I want to know more about certain characters, but, like, it's not like I needed to. But, like, this movie, more than any other Star Wars film, like, sometimes, like, Cassian's background, like, Jin's, like, there's so much, like, they've had such a sordid past, kind of a lot of, psychological abuse, it seems. I mean, Jin had a pretty rough upbringing. I mean, she basically was raised by a terrorist and then set free. You know, she actually, she basically kind of started as a rebel and then is at a point in her life that, the rebellion means nothing to her anymore. Like, there's a lot going on there. Mm-hmm. But we don't get a lot of that struggle in the movie. What's strange, the novelization actually, I think, does a much better job of that. Jin has constant, fever dreams or lucid dreams about being back in the hull, waiting for her parents or, some savior to come get her. And the conditions in the hull keep on reflecting what's going on in her life during the events of Rogue One. And it's very, I thought all that was very well written. I mean, she's constantly going back between her Coruscant apartment and the man in white or the troopers in black. And it's, there's a lot of really good symbolism going on there to kind of move Jin's character along, that the movie kind of, the rebellion totally took out her dad. And in the book, she hates her dad for abandoning her. And, or, she feels has abandoned her. And in the movie, she's just, she's ready to go, take on the Empire. But it's much more well put together in the novelization. And I think we missed that in the movie.
So what you've been getting, Matt, I've been sending you literally every single page of added content to the comics. So between the two, I'm guessing that you're going to say, if you spend money on one, let it be the novel.
I would say, based on what you've sent me, I would say definitely the novel.
One of my favorite things about the comics so far, though, is you get a fair amount of greater establishing moments for Bodhi Rook.
Yes, the book did not have as many, it did have some great Bodhi Rook stuff, but not a lot. And the stuff you've been sending me has been pretty good from the comic.
So that's so far the biggest change. It's not done yet. I think where are we? Vader and Krennic's confrontation on Mustafar and Galen Erso getting blasted. And they wrote in Jin's moment of... we're rebels, aren't we? Let's rebel. But in a scene that was not the same scene and was way better delivered than it was in that trailer. I don't know if that was ever filmed. There was a scene with Mon Mothma sort of apologizing and consoling Jin after the death of her father, which was nice. The other things that have shown and showcased the changes is the Rogue One visual guide had conflicting info from the film, including placement of the Scarif comm tower, which was one building. Everything was in one building in the film, but was in two separate buildings originally, hence the running across the beach shot with the plans thing from the trailer, which is, that was, with all the explosions and everything, clearly, the scene, they had to work between two separate towers. The art of book also shows two separate towers. And then there was an ABC program that was showcasing the creation of K2SO, which unceremoniously showed an alternate death scene for K2 and Cassian Andor. Boom. They died in front of a bunker door.
Pretty shocking that it just kind of was out there.
And so like we said, these changes, they might not matter, but it's fascinating how much hasn't been shared about this process. Maybe someday they'll be ready to be. They don't want to get eviscerated. They don't want to get torn apart. And that's not why we're here. We're not here to eviscerate. We're not here to tear apart. We're here to just figure this shit out because we don't know why these choices were made. We don't know, what really happened in terms of, did they make a film that was too dark and it needed to be lightened up? Did the story has been told that originally at least Jin and Cassian were going to survive, and that Disney was like, you got to kill him. Go ahead and kill him. No big deal. And that surprised the filmmakers, which is weird because, they didn't ask. Okay. I don't know if I believe that or not, but at the very least, it seems like they were actually making a darker film. And they made a film that was still dark with a bleak ending, but lightened it up and then added a bunch of other stuff like Tarkin and the blockade runner sequence, which was totally worth it for the Vader, but also totally damned in many regards the connective tissue between A New Hope, which it seemed like they thought they were like trying to give fans more value, but really it just fucks up the timeline.
Yeah, I'm very confused now. I mean, the ship is literally fleeing from, you know, the Admiral Raddus's ship. And in the next, you know, the beginning of the next movie, she's claiming that they're just a counselor ship. Like, not exactly the best excuse.
Like, can you imagine, like, I don't know, let's say somebody like Pablo Hidalgo be like, you gotta be kidding me. How can you, I mean, just change the dialogue, do something, because we can't, this doesn't make sense. You realize the Twitter conversations I'm going to have about this. Do you understand what you're doing?
Well, if you watch like these YouTube clips where people put the end of one to the beginning of the other, and you hear the anger in Vader's voice, we're like, you are part of the Rebel Alliance. And like, it's, he's kind of had it. Like he literally just saw you 10 minutes ago. So
yeah, but I also saw them 10 minutes ago, and he had no problem cutting down every Alderaanian like honor guard on the way to that door. But then all of a sudden is like, you know, questioning them and kind of playing coy with the whole, like, where's the ambassador? And like, you know, proclaiming her part of the Rebel Alliance. Like, clearly, no,
he's not asking where the ambassador is. He's like, where are the plans? Cause like, he's choking this one dude out. Cause they can't find them. They know they're on the ship. He knows they're on the ship. He saw them run into the ship. He goes, and the stormtroopers say, sorry, sir, we can't find the plans. And he's just like, where are those plans? He's choking this guy. And he's like, oh, this is a consular ship. And then he's just like, dude, you think I was fucking born yesterday? Where's the ambassador? So it's like a trick question. It's not real. It's rhetorical.
Well, I mean, once again, it, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that he was slashing them all to death, like just, you know, 5 minutes prior, like it sounds, you know, the conversation makes a little more sense without that going on.
Well, I mean, now he needs them alive now because he doesn't know where the plans are. He can't just like, well, you need to shrug and say go home.
He could blow up the ship.
But if you blow up the ship, you might blow up the evidence of where the plans went.
I mean, I think
we're
looking a little too. I mean, it is just as bad as not shooting the escape pod because there's no life signs. But
well, that was always a problem. You didn't need Rogue One for that.
Mm-hmm. Like, where did Leia get that dress on Endor? I hope they answer that one day.
Which I should add, because this isn't a Star Wars news episode, you totally should start watching Forces of Destiny, the very brief animated short series that's airing on Disney's YouTube channel right now. We'll link to it on this episode's page. And they're a lot of fun. They're great. There was a kind of weak episode with Leia on Endor where you find out, well, you see her get the dress on Endor, but it still doesn't explain the age-old question of what? Where the Ewoks made that
good tailors. Those Ewoks are good tailors.
they saw her, they sized her up, boom, done. Here it is, pressed and folded. Enjoy. So, you know, but the Rey ones are great.
Yeah, I do really like the Rey ones.
So, a little bit of fun pre-production stuff from Rogue One. There was a panel at Star Wars Celebration with production designer Doug Chang. Who showcased that the Rebel base, there were going to be two Rebel bases originally. They were going to sort of travel between the two of them, and we're going to see Dantooine. So when Leia, you know, says up the base is on Dantooine, well, there was a base on Dantooine, and it was going to be filmed in Smoo Cave in Scotland. They were going to have laser cut rooms, so it would look like a rocky, wet version of Echo Base on Hoth. The idea being that, you know, these installations, these secret installations, are sort of modular. They come in, they laser out a mountain and hide themselves.
It looks spectacular.
It did look amazing. And the good news is that, you know, they never let anything go to waste. And so if we ever do see Dantooine in a thing again, they did love it. They loved it a lot and would really hope to use it. Editors John Gilroy and Colin Godey had an interview where they gave a lot of insight to things. They pointed out that the largest changes happened in the third act, so all the Scarif sequences. Gilroy said the third act had a lot going on. You have like 7 different action venues. The mechanics of the act change quite a bit in terms of the characters, and I don't want to go into too much detail about what had been there before, but it was different, is the only thing that people have been able to safely say, because they're all very concerned about what they can and cannot say. The official statement was that Gareth Edwards wanted to change how Jyn was introduced after the prologue, but deciding to make the intro that we saw where she was locked up meant that they had to change other moments so that everything was cohesive. Goaty said when you see Jin as an adult, originally she was in a meeting room just doing rebel stuff. That's not a nice introduction. So having her in prison and then the prison break with Cassian on a mission, everybody was a bit more ballsy, a bit more exciting, a bit more interesting. Of course, things like that have a ripple effect all through the movie. So there was a lot of work to do. And that, you know, all that sounds like, okay, that's totally reasonable. The movie was darker but boring. So they had to punch it up and then they had to change everything else in sequence. And the best way they came up with for how to punch up Jin was to make her disenfranchised with the Rebellion or things like the Rebellion. Cool. Reasonable. Okay.
You know, it's interesting. I feel like it wasn't until the second time I saw the movie that, like, I understand that they mentioned, you know, she grew up with Saw, but for some reason I kind of pictured her as more of a Han Solo type person before she got thrown in prison. Kind of just criminal as opposed to a rebel slash terrorist. And so, like, I definitely like the change that she was sort of disenfranchised person, but, like, I was a little confused on it, but that was probably just me.
I think we were all sort of expecting that because that was, in very broad strokes, what had been sold to us. No one said anything specific, but that was definitely the impression that it was given, I feel.
That she was a former terrorist or that she was just a criminal?
She was a Han Solo type.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'd say that's what I think it is.
Mon Mothma was reading her rap sheet.
Yeah, which to me sounds more like, you know, they just broke her out of prison. And her only connection to Rebellion and things like that was her father. That was, like, you know, her special circumstance. But, you know, then as kind of, like, spent more time paying attention, you know, that she was a little bit older when Saw got rid of her. And I haven't gotten to what she was doing after Saw left her yet in Rebel Rising, but once I do, we'll find out if she continues that path or she did abandon it like Cassian claims.
With Cassian, the early scene with him doing the spy stuff, which was, you know, very, very cool. And then also Bodhi being escorted through Jedha by Saw's people. Apparently all that was new, totally added, just to make things more exciting, just to make the movie have a more impactful start.
That is such a very blunt introduction to Cassian that I've got to imagine there are aspects of his story that have been cut later on. And I don't know if I believe that that was added later. I mean, he just, like, you know, he kind of ruthlessly murders that guy. And it's cool. It's a very unique take on the idea of being a rebel. But I didn't see where his character arc went, where suddenly he was feeling really bad about all this stuff. I will say, once again, the novelization version, when he's about to take out Galen Erso on Edu, I mean, he, like, tosses the gun aside, and he's just distraught, and there's, like, tears in his eyes. Like, he can no longer do it. Like, he can no longer be an assassin. And, like, I don't know. I just feel like it plays stronger. I felt Cassian was very interesting. He might be my favorite of that group. But I don't know if the movie was very as effective as it could have been.
I sure hope he's going to be in that Han Solo movie.
Me too.
But, I mean,
with Jabba.
With Yaba. I mean, come on.
Yaba.
But if he's doing that cold-blooded killer stuff, did it feel natural in the novel for him to then, like, crack up with Galen Erso? Why did Galen Erso cause that reaction if he's such a cold-blooded killer? Did it feel natural?
It was Jin. I mean, it really was, like, kind of the sort of, it was the constant lying during their mission together. Like, that he was, you know, almost he felt everything he was saying to her was a lie. And it was starting to, like, really weigh down on him in that regard.
And to know that you need to shoot the father of the person who was pretty good in a fight and is basically on your side.
Yeah.
So, the death of the main characters, Matt, you were convinced that the folks weren't going to die in this movie. Not all of them, anyway.
Yeah, just, you know, hey, I was a victim of thinking that I knew too much about the way movies are made these days. And I was like, these are characters that they can totally market for years to come. And, you know, they're all kind of, I mean, particularly Felicity Jones herself is very up and coming actor. And I just assume that with what Marvel is doing with having characters come together in Avengers films and Civil War and everything else, that it would be a great model to be able to build up their own ensemble type thing that they could have, that you could have a post Yavin, like once the Han Solo origin film was out, you could do a movie that takes place after A New Hope where, you know, she's on another mission, you know, to take down the Empire and they need a good smuggler to, like, get her in. And it could be like Aaron Reich and Felicity Jones starring in some sort of, like, team up movie. So I assume she would have survived. But hey, they caught me by surprise.
Yeah, there's tons and tons of quotes from Gareth Edwards about this experience. For instance, the original instinct was that they should all die. It's worth it. If you're going to give your life for anything, give your life for this, to destroy a weapon that's going to kill you all anyway. That's what we always wanted to do, but we never explored it because we were afraid that Disney might not let us do it, that Disney might think it's too dark for Star Wars movie or for their brand. Just so weird you wouldn't ask.
Yeah. Yeah, that is strange. I wonder if they considered it. I mean, I don't know.
Considered what? Considered telling them, yeah, don't kill them? Or I mean, what? Like,
Or if they were, it's just an active discussions about whether or not they should. Like, you know, I don't know if it was really like they went about doing their own thing with the idea that the characters were all going to live, and then Disney was like, nah, just kill them. Like, I think they probably went through and said, are these characters, like, marketable? Can we sign them to multi-contract, you know, multi-picture contracts? Can we, you know, see what they could do? And then probably decided, like, no, let's just, you know, not worth it. Which, I have to say, like, is brave and is cool. And I think I liked all of their deaths, I think, in the course of the movie and the way it worked. I don't think they had to die. I know a lot of fans argue that. I don't understand that argument. Like, you know, it doesn't say anything in the beginning of A New Hope to say that everybody died at that battle. It literally actually says the rebellion won their first victory, which, you know, as it turned out, they won, but man, you know, it was quite a loss.
They lost an entire squadron.
Yeah, I mean, the whole squadron, I'm sure, I like, hard to tell, but I think, you know, probably Admiral Raddus and his entire, I mean, they disabled the ship.
Yeah,
I'm
no doubt.
They're
I
all
mean,
dead.
Fuck, yeah. A pity, because I love Raddus, but.
Yeah, Raddus is terrific. And, you know, I never understood the weird argument that a lot of fans have that, like, because they're not in A New Hope, they have to die. Like, Mon Mothma wasn't in A New Hope. Does that mean she didn't join the rebellion until just before Jedi? Like, that doesn't, like, none of that really made any sense to me. But, hey, it was good because it actually took me by surprise in the theaters, which is awesome because I spoiled myself heavily on this movie, and yet they still managed to surprise me.
Screenwriter Chris White said, they finally went off and fought for it. We told them we feel they all need to die, and Kathleen Kennedy and everyone else said go for it. We got the ending we wanted. Bodhi Rook, Truett Imwey, and Baze Malbus didn't yet exist, but in the original draft, K2 did, and he died. Originally, the only survivors were Cassian, who had a different name, and Jyn Erso, who was a sergeant. They both escaped Scarif in those last moments. Jyn and Cassian escaped the facility with plans in hand, carrying the data tapes across the beach. Gary Whitta then also explained a little bit more. A rebel ship came down and got them off the surface. The transfer of the plans happened later. They jumped away, and later Leia's ship came from Alderaan to help them. The ship-to-ship data transfer happened off Scarif. Vader at the end was a last-minute inclusion, but in the original ending, Vader was still in pursuit, and he began attacking Jyn's shuttle as the rebels transmitted the stolen information from the data tapes to Leia's ship. Vader succeeds in breaching the rebel shields, and he destroys Erso's shuttle. The audience would have been left wondering if Jyn and the other heroes made it out alive, but as Vader's Star Destroyer goes to chase after Leia in the Tantine 4, the camera would have panned to the floating fragments of the debris from the destroyed ship and would have been revealed that Erso and Andor got away in an escape pod just in time. The pod looked like another piece of debris.
It could have been cool.
Yeah, I honestly, we've already discussed at some length the problem with what happened with the trade-off of plans. So, whereas, you know, I don't, whether Jyn or Cassian survive, I think that we got the better ending for them in the movie that was released in theaters. I think Vader tearing apart another ship was the best way. I mean, and granted, he was tearing apart Raddus's ship, but like Vader being not quite on top of, like, within force grasping distance to the ship with the plans on it, that would have been better for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. The Vader sequence is great. Like, if it had taken place, like, I don't know, in the bunker on Scarif or something, you know, and Scarif didn't necessarily need to be destroyed by the Death Star. I will say also, I was never a fan of the single reactor ignition. Like, Right. Oh, you know, it's a big deal when Alderaan blows up, so let's not blow up a whole planet. Let's just blow up a city. So we'll just do single reactors just fine. Like, I feel like that was sort of just we definitely want the Death Star to be powerful, but we can't, like, you know, take away the impact of Alderaan's destruction, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and it was... Whereas it's a bit like, oh, come on. I mean, we know we have seen the Death Star blow stuff up since 1977. Mm-hmm. So is it the idea that, like, it could also just kind of, like, boop out a city? It seems a little silly because it's meant to be such a threatening weapon. But, I mean, that's a good plan for the Emperor to have built the capacity to destroy something on a smaller scale like that, because maybe they want the resources a planet has, and they want to subdue the planet by being like, all right, your capital city, it's gone. So maybe in the end it makes a lot of sense. And they were able to spin it in a way so that the you know, the Senate was told it was some kind of big
mining disaster.
So the Empire could then get away with, like, doing some other shit while the Senate was still, you know, blind.
Right. Well, I mean, the Imperial Senate does get disbanded within, like, a day of
true
of this movie.
We don't really know how long Vader's chasing Leia.
It's true. That is true.
That's the one saving grace to all of this, is we don't know how long. Like, is it long enough that he's like, okay, there's a blockade runner. Let's just, is this the right one? We'll find out.
Yeah, well, I think Gareth Edwards had said at a certain point that he always imagined New Hope starting 5 minutes after Rogue One ended. Like, that's how he was originally pitching it, even at Celebration.
Fair point.
But officially, who knows? But hey, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll get a little comic book that takes place between, where, you know, they're, like, at warp for several days or something like that. Like, how far away is Scarif from Tatooine?
We certainly must know that, right?
I don't know the location of the new canon, I guess. I mean, a lot of the planets are in the same spot, but I don't know where the new planets are from the new movies.
Hmm.
I will say, the Disney movies, Hyperspace, they're rewriting the rules, which is fine, because I guess they've never been established. But all that, like, radio chatter during Hyperspace and, like, Poe being able to come out of Hyperspace on command, like, you know, the sort of, you know, the shield is down and they get that radio communication and Force Awakens, so they simply, like, power down hyperdrive as if they're, like, I don't know if they're in light speed just circling around Starkiller Base or what's going on there. But, you know, there's definitely, like, I don't think it takes very long to travel through hyperspace anymore. Or it's very complicated. I mean, both, you know, Han went to hyperspace inside a docking bay, and then in Rogue One, they went into hyperspace while they're in atmosphere. Like, it doesn't matter anymore.
Here's something we know very little about, and that's the addition of Tarkin. Matt, you're a pretty big proponent that Tarkin was a last-minute addition. But the thing is, we actually know nothing about the timeline for that. I've sat in on a whole panel almost entirely dedicated to the creation of Tarkin at Celebration. I don't really think he was pulled off particularly well. I think they still they needed a bit more refinement to really truly be believable on screen. But the process,
I will argue, that might be a time thing.
Yeah, well, that's very fair. The process is at the very least fascinating, but I can't imagine them developing something like this and thinking, "Oh, this is a good last minute addition. Let's reshape the film to include this inexplicable display of, like, technological advancement." Was it necessary? Why would they? You know, adding more Darth Vader, I get. They can sell Darth Vader. But Grand Moff Tarkin is a fan favorite character. No one's feeling super love for Grand Moff Tarkin unless they, like, you know, they're deep into Star Wars. So why is
I would say first that they should have been feeling that love to get more Tarkin. But I understand what you mean. Like, yeah, he's not exactly what people are, you know.
No, what they want is they want inexplicable Ponda Baba and C-3PO.
Ugh, gosh. You know, there's definitely something weird about the Tarkin edition, because, yeah, it doesn't look as, I would argue the Leia one looks a little bit better, and also that technology is really good. Obviously, on living actors, it's been very effective. The Marvel series has done it amazingly in a number of films now. And it was also very good in the Fast and Furious movie where Paul Walker had just passed away, where they used his brother and then mapped his face over it, and it was really good. So I would say Tarkin probably could have used some more seasoning, a little more time in the oven. But the reason I think it was a last-minute addition is because Krennic is the most neutered villain in, like, Star Wars history. Like, he spends an entire movie one step behind the good guys, which is doesn't make for a great villain. Like, I feel like the only villainous thing he managed to accomplish, like, without Tarkin's, you know, assistance is, you know, killing Jin's mother and then, taking her father. But for the rest of the movie, he doesn't know about the leaks in his own base. He doesn't, you know, he loses command of the project. He grovels the Vader and gets choked for it. He, you know, Jin gets the best of him on Scarif. Like, you know, his troops on Scarif don't even deploy the garrison properly. I will say he does deliver some great lines, but they're always because he's, like, he's behind the eight ball the entire movie. And it's just annoying because he ends up being, like, completely unthreatening.
And that's like, all true, yeah.
Yeah, and I want to add, Ben Mendelsohn is a terrific actor, and what a wasted opportunity, like, because he could have probably been an amazing Imperial. Even, like, Ben Mendelsohn himself said that they filmed various versions of, like, all his different scenes throughout the entire movie, and then when he saw the finished cut, like, he was shocked by how many of the scenes went with a certain version. The quote that he has is that, like, there was enormous differences within 20 or 30 of the scenes. So I gotta imagine Krennic, you know, used to be the big bad, and then he ended up being kind of like the stooge to Tarkin and Vader. Because, I mean, I don't even think, like, yeah, sure, he destroys Jedha City, but, like, I mean, really, Tarkin was overseeing it. I mean, he even takes credit for it, you know?
The narrative has become Krennic as a symbol for the Empire eating its people alive.
Right.
And that's kind of interesting, but also a shame because he's a great actor and because the character was designed in such a way to show that could, like, he represents a ton of possibilities for what was probably filmed and was not realized in the final version of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And why, of all the character punching up that they did, why did they neuter Krennic?
Yeah, I don't understand that. Yeah, the article about from Ben Mendelsohn, like, goes on to say that there's more Darth Vader footage to go around than the actual movie offers. Krennic tells Vader in a missing scene, "The power we're dealing with is immeasurable." It's like Krennic, who is scared of Darth Vader in the final cut, is seen standing his ground with the Sith Lord. And there's even a rumor, like, I remember an article a couple months ago, a rumor that, like, he tries taking a shot at Vader at one point.
Yeah, it was at least boarded. But yeah, no, I've seen materials pertaining to a scene where he attempts to fire at Vader.
Yeah, which I gotta say, out of all the things, all the characters kind of like having their histories rewritten, the most shameful thing might be what happened to Krennic, because I think there was a lot of great potential there.
Yeah, and this leads to our lasting questions about Rogue One. Like, what does it all mean? This is the inaugural concept piece for expanded universe Star Wars filmmaking, and what kind of precedents has it set? Why was it revised so much? Did we get a better movie, or did we get a movie that was more doctored to make the most money, placate the most fans? Why is it that The Last Jedi seems to indicate so much hands-off filmmaking, that Rian Johnson has had so much freedom, and then Rogue One was, you know, severely doctored? Was it simply that the experiment of the anthology films was scary enough to someone in Lucasfilm, Disney, wherever?
Well, after watching it a few more times, the feeling that I kind of go with is that when a scene feels like, oh, this seems like it was added later, or even if you're not entirely sure, I feel like all the scenes that were added were indeed to expand upon the characters. Like, I know we still feel like we wanted a little bit more, but all those earlier scenes, they are character-driven, and they are meant to show you something more about them. So I personally err on the side of it's a better film because of it. I mean, also because we don't really know what we're missing with some of the other things, but, you know, if all the other things were maybe a little too conflicting or a little too vague or even a little bit too boring, all these things that were added seem to at least make it more exciting, interesting, and different. Except for the Bogan thing. What was that? Is it the Bogan, that weird tentacle monster that Saw Gerrera had?
No, the it's the Bogullet.
Bogullet, that's it. Yeah, the Bogan is the old
he knows the truth
term for the Force.
Yeah, actually, he's the only one who knows if we ended up with a stronger movie.
Well, I was like, that scene, out of the whole movie, that's the one scene that still really bothers me, because I'm just like, okay, we set it up that it knows the truth, and if you lie, it'll kill you. He survives. But then Saul Guerrero is like, that pilot is still lying. I'm just like, well, why did
he said that you have a tendency to lose your mind. And so it's like, okay, so he's going to be like a vegetable for the rest of the movie. No, he was fine after, you know, they said hi to him eventually. Like, I don't, like, yeah. Yeah,
the scene had no bearing on the rest of the film whatsoever.
Nah. I will say that entire thing, it was not flawless because Saw still, you know, makes it sound like Bodhi's going to fucking die, and he doesn't. But the entire process of what Bodhi's going through was so much better handled in the comics. Like, so much better. Like, yeah, if they'd done it like that in the movie, it would have been an improvement. But the thing is that the comic establishes the capacity to show flashes of character memories. That's part of the comics narrative, and they never did that in the film. So that was a huge component of Bodhi's mind cycling through things, putting himself in different situations, like seeing scenes from different perspectives. And basically you watch him sort of go mad and have the opportunity to claw his way out of that madness.
Hmm. That sounds cool.
It happens in passing, but it is an improvement.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard references that Bull Gullet could return in Last Jedi, that like that it was actually a setup. But I've also heard the same for Jeddah. And I do think they'll go back to Jeddah one day. I think it would be cool if like Episode 9 featured the ruins of Jeddah and it was a significant aspect to like the origins of the Jedi or something. But yeah, I don't know.
And then Basil and Cherry can then bump into somebody and be like, watch where you're going. And we're like, oh, they're going to die soon.
I hope Dr. Evazan and Ponda Baba are in every single Star Wars spinoff.
Like, okay, so we've thrown shade. I've probably done this before. Even we threw shade for the blockade runner scene fucking up the timeline, but really Ponda Baba and Dr. Evazan, like that is what fucks things up. So you mean to tell me that within like half an hour or, you know, like they got on a shuttle that just so happened to be going directly to Tatooine, just coincidentally, like they escaped total annihilation and ended up in the trajectory of the entire plot.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah, totally.
Cool. Why?
I don't know. And what's worse is like the prosthetics didn't actually look like, they didn't look like the Evazan and Ponda Baba from, like, they were a little thinner. I don't know. It was weird. It was awful. It was awful. And here's the thing, though, as we may have discussed on air before, but we definitely have discussed off air. Like, when I saw the movie on opening night, like, people cheered when they showed up. Like, you know, if we don't like the Evazan Ponda Baba gratuitous cameos, like, you know, we gotta stop clapping. But I have a feeling that people like them. So, you know.
And here's the thing, like, I love cameos for background characters. That's super fun. It's just that when they did them in this movie, they sucked.
Yeah.
Like, and they didn't have to. This is another beautiful opportunity whizzing by you on the highway of like, oh boy, it could have been something else, but instead it was that. I mean, it could have been like Cad Bane, you know, cussing them out. Like,
yep.
You know, wow. Now that's a deep cut that would have delighted a lot of young people.
That would have been amazing.
Could have been Wilroy Hood buying an ice cream maker.
Yeah. Chopper and Ghost were perfect. And yes. I don't mind that 3PO and R2 were shown right there. I just wish that line had been different.
It was a dumb line. It was a really like
terrible line.
It was like in the last Christopher Nolan Batman movie where they're like, oh wait, your name's actually Robin? Weird.
Yeah.
Come on.
Which makes no sense. But so to answer the big crux of the question, stronger film, I'm going to go with, we ended up with a stronger film that is safer, but I don't think it's because where they were going with it was a bad idea. I think it was, they chose, like, no offense, I think Gareth Edwards is a very charming, like, pretty decently talented guy. But I don't know if he was the right person to ask to do a war film. I think this movie could have been different. And also, you know what? I don't even want to put it all on him. I also want to put it on where they started with the writers, like with Gary Whitta doing the first like draft. You know, I don't know if this is the right, like, if they wanted to make that dark film they initially conceived of, that John Knoll initially pitched to Kathleen Kennedy. I don't know if they went the right place to have it written. I think this, the film we ended up with on screen was stronger than the one that they initially went out to make. But the idea could have been a much better non-traditional film.
You can find the script for The Force Awakens online, but you can't find Rogue One.
That is very interesting. And we've seen what Gareth Edwards is capable of. like the first act of Godzilla is amazing. And most of his indie film Monsters is also amazing. And that what that proves to me is that Gareth Edwards' primary palette, the thing he excels at, the thing that he is maybe even a master of, is mood, atmosphere, and emotional tension. With an ensemble cast in a major blockbuster, like it didn't land. And you see that in the second and third acts of Godzilla. And in Rogue One is a far better film than that movie, but not a far better film than the first act of that movie.
Right. And by the way, Tony Gilroy also did, you know, mop up directing on Godzilla as well.
Yes, he did. That's something else that we don't know an awful lot about.
Yeah.
And maybe they're, you know, I've heard different interpretations of that. Like, is it that he mopped up, or is it that they like have a working relationship where like he's the guy who knows how to steer all of Gareth's impressionistic ideas into a blockbuster film? I don't know. But I know that I like when Gareth does his thing very much. And I would like to see a Star Wars film by him where he has the freedom to just do a bunch of long, moody shots. But that leads us to our final question for this episode. How will Rogue One be remembered?
And I think this is the most important question, because Star Wars is about legacies. And, you know, Marvel, I don't know if you guys saw the announcement that, you know, Marvel is ending this story arc after 26 films.
I imagine
is probably going to lead to some sort of like reboot of the universe or something.
Hmm.
And we're going to reach a point where Star Wars is in the teens, and like we're actually not even that far from it. Like someday we're going to hit, you know, 20 Star Wars films, which is crazy to think about. And the nice thing that Marvel has going for it is they have a legacy of these characters having some sort of basis. So, like, you know, even if their movies come and go, like, they still have something to fall back on. But are we going to remember Rogue One when we're 20 movies in? Is that the one people are going to be like, oh, yeah, that one? And I say that because at Celebration this year, which is our first real chance to see how people felt about Rogue One, like, all together, like, I saw not that much cosplay. The cast wasn't there, like, to on panels.
Well, yeah, that's a weird thing. They were there, but they were there for autographs. There were no... Yep. All the Rogue One panels were dedicated to the technical aspects of Rogue One, and they were great panels. But where were the opportunities for the cast to speak? Well, understandably, they were not given the opportunity to speak because that would be dangerous.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, it's just... And, you know, like, these characters, they all died. So, like, they don't even have a legacy for the future. The only legacy that they have for further stories is, you know, comics and books, I guess, unless they get some movies where they show up every once in a while.
Well, I mean, in August, we are getting the first Rogue One thing that's not an adaptation, the prequel comic of how Cassian and K2 met.
Yes. Which, you know, is exciting. I hope it lives on. Like, I hope, like the other film, like, you know, we're still... Like, yes, the prequel era stuff has slowed down since Disney, you know, made their acquisition, understandably. But, you know, Clone Wars still has its enduring legacy. And, you know, when the Expanded Universe was going strong, they were still making books about Obi-Wan, still making books about Qui-Gon and Mace Windu and everything else. And, like, I don't know how long they'll be doing Rogue One stuff. Are they only going to be doing things for the months before and the year after the films come out, and then it's gone? If it doesn't live on, does that mean it wasn't successful? Or it doesn't matter as long as it made money and it made $1 billion. So, sure, I guess if that's how you measure success, it's successful, but it's not much of a legacy.
No, I mean, and the characters don't need to live to have legacy. Like, this is an important part of the Star Wars story. This really, you know, enhanced the stakes. If you're watching these films for the first time and you watch Rogue One and you go to A New Hope, you might even be a little disappointed because you're like, wait, we got to follow this fucking farm boy now? I just watched some hardened criminals do some shit.
Yep.
But it's... I guess we'll see how much backstory they're given. We're going to see some Jyn Erso in the Forces of Destiny cartoon. And
yeah, it's interesting too. So much like in broad strokes has already been said about their previous life. Like, it's like they didn't have it in the movie, so they were like, well, we need to explain it now. Like, you know, Basil and Cherries were kind of like stuck on Jedha doing their thing for years, and kind of that book, like, yeah, you could have some one-off adventures, but like they've already kind of limited themselves to, unless they finally tell us what the Temple of Kyber was like pre-Empire, you know, and then so we have like real young Basil and Cherries. But, you know, Jin's history from, you know, her being in the hole on Lamu up to, you know, Rogue One is kind of like told in Rebel Rising. It's like they filled in all those details. She spent a lot of time living on an island with Saw. Like, you know, it's, I don't, it's weird. I would not be surprised to see Lucasfilm kind of abandon these characters to very little ongoing adventures. Which is a shame.
I mean, would you think that they would actively dissuade people from using them? Or would they be like, yeah, sure, why not? No one cares.
I don't know. That's, I will, I guess it depends on, you know, if the people at Marvel, or I would imagine Marvel and more so than the, you know, Del Rey, the books team would want to tap into the I think it's a much more interesting era for them. But I don't know, maybe we'll eventually get something. Even like the way they handle the prequels now, where it's like these character series, you know, it's like they're not, it's not like Mace Windu and the, you know, Wind Raiders of whatever. It's just like Mace Windu, like this 5-issue miniseries is like his, you know, that's the extent of his adventures, you know. Like, I don't know, I'm not sure I'm a fan of how they've been kind of going at the non-original trilogy eras of more storytelling.
Well, I think in the grand scheme of things, as far as legacy is concerned, to compare it, I would say if when Star Wars gets to the point where it has like over 20 movies the same way like Bond does, I think Rogue One's going to be seen more like that one-off, like on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah.
You know?
Which ain't a bad thing, because these days, yeah, you know, we celebrate Omis.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like we, like, Rogue One may be like on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and by the way things were sounding, maybe we narrowly avoided Han Solo being compared to the 1960s Casino Royale.
Yeah, we'll see. It'd just be interesting to go to a Star Wars celebration in 15 years, and like, how am I going to react when I see someone cosplaying as Jyn Erso? I'm going to go like, holy crap, a Jyn Erso. Or I'm going to be like, oh, there's another Jyn Erso. Which I think it's better when you think, oh, there's another Jyn Erso, because it means that it's still fresh in people's minds. But I have a feeling that Rogue One will be kind of like a, oh yeah, I remember that movie.
And is that okay? I mean, and that's the big question, because I mean, because we want there to be such a great diversity of Star Wars anthology films that, you know, that there could be like experimental films, there could be forgettable films, there could be mistakes that are made.
Yeah.
So I suppose time will tell how much we really do get to know about how this movie was made and when these things actually happened, because, you know, I believe that most of the things they say happened, but it's when they happened that is the big ambiguous point. And a lot of people covering for a lot of other people, which is fine, because I think that everybody involved was, you know, good at their jobs and nice folks. But somewhere along the line, I would love to know, you know, where the decision was made to make these changes and why.
Yeah, filmmaking's interesting. We want to know those things. Like, yeah, freaking Twitter will go a little crazy, but like, don't listen, you know, don't listen to the trolls. Like, I want to know about these things more for the oral histories, for the, you know, like the diverging paths of Star Wars, not because I want to like eviscerate somebody. Like, you know, I want to know.
Yeah.
And I think even if you remove the Darth Vader lightsaber hallway sequence, the whole third act of that movie is like, I think that's going to be some classic Star Wars battle scenes. Like, it's going to be up there with like the Battle of Hoth and stuff. People are just going to remember it because it's like, I mean, maybe it only feels that way now because it's been so long since we've seen, as Cap put it, a Star War. But like it's just a classic era battle that had so much riding on it and was also so much fun to behold.
By the way, and if Lucasfilm is out there listening, and I hope they are. Like, if they want to make some Cassian Andor prequel films in which, like, it's basically James Bond films where he goes into Mon Mothma's, you know, M's office every day and gets, like, a mission, I'm totally game with that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I mean, the Diego Luna fan club is very strong. And, his presence in a movie guarantees butts in seats. That's a fact. That's an international fact. He's a very charming man. He's a very handsome man, and I want to see him on screen with his one true love, Jabba the Hutt.
Yes.
So, I was just going to say, if you want to make it happen, we need to tell Diego Luna that we have a script where Cassian Andor has to infiltrate Jabba's cartel, and he has to come face-to-face with him and, like, broker some sort of deal
under
the table for the rebellion.
Let's just remake License to Kill, where he makes friends with Jabba, and, like, then he's, like, conflicted about whether or not he should betray his new friend. Like...
Yes.
That'd be awesome.
Oh, I want it. I want it so bad. By the way, if for some reason the Diego Luna and Jabba the Hutt, a.k.a. Jabba, if that doesn't make any sense to you, we got a YouTube video that you really need to watch. It's super important. It's really fucking important that you watch this video.
Might be the most important thing you get out of this podcast.
Yeah. You really got to check this out. So we'll link to a video about the relationship between Diego Luna and Jabba. Come on.
Jabba, come on. Touching his, you know, like his belly. I'm so tempted. The texture of Jabba is something I need to discover.
I believe that's it. That's everything that we've learned in the 6 months since Rogue One has come out and all of our quandaries, questions, and concerns pertaining to that. Still a fantastic movie filled with characters that I love and I want to see more of, and I hope that its legacy doesn't die. I want this movie to carry on because there's parts of it that are very, very worthy of carrying on as cornerstones of the Rogues Gallery of Star Wars.
Yeah, I think Jedha City is like one of the best things that's been added to Star Wars in like a very, very, very long time. And I think lots of expanded universe writers and illustrators could do amazing things with Jedha in the future. Among many other great things in Rogue One. But, like, there are things about Rogue One that are some of, like, my favorite things in Star Wars.
So there you have it. Now, something I want to point out is you can always contact us. We are extremely accessible. You can find us on Facebook on the Star Wars Spoilers group. Or if that's too spoilerific for you and you don't like to venture beyond the blast doors, well, that's fine. You can email starwars@nerdyshow.com or talk to us on the Nerdy Show forums or on Reddit for that matter. You can comment on this episode's page. Also, you can indeed rate and review us on iTunes. Ideally with a 5-star review, but you know, you're just being honest. And also there's Podchaser. Podchaser is a brand new platform which allows you to rate and review not just series, but specific episodes. Since our last episode where I put out a call to arms for people to rate our individual episodes, we got some. So thank you so much, everybody, and keep them coming. Every time a new episode of any show you love on the Nerdy Show Network comes out, hop on a Podchaser and give us your thoughts or just click a review number, star count, you know, whatever works. If you haven't checked out Podchaser yet, it is in closed beta right now, and that means you need access codes to get in there. So to do that, you just go to nerdyshow.com/podchaser, and there you will see all the information you need about what Podchaser is, how it works, and also our beta key codes, which are Nerdy and Nerdy Show. We will be back in probably a couple weeks with a brand new deluge of Star Wars news. We have D23 and San Diego Comic-Con on the horizon, where there is certain to be a good amount of reveals, maybe so much as a new trailer for The Last Jedi, but time will tell. As always, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time on State of the Empire.